to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast. This is a show where we're joined by experts to help us get better at helping the person with the problem. Today, I've got Ben Darlow with me. Ben is a primary healthcare academic at the University of Otago Wellington campus. He is a practicing physiotherapist. He's one of a few physiotherapy specialists here in New Zealand and all-round good dude. And I've actually had the privilege of sitting in a couple of consultations with Ben with patients, and his clinical knowledge is absolutely fantastic, but just the way that he communicates with patients and the way that he puts across ideas and holds space for them is really, really impressive as well. So I'm excited to talk to you tonight, Ben.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure, mate. It's a pleasure. I always like to kick things off just by asking, why do you care about the art of healthcare? Why do you care about the human side of healthcare?
Well, yes, I mean, healthcare for me is all about humans, and the science is only a way of helping or informing the way that we go and we work with humans. And I guess for me, a key focus has always been, I'm really interested in how people make sense of their health and how that then informs their health behaviors. And then through that is how we can, you know, explore what's going on. And then if we see opportunities whereby different information or different ideas or concepts might be helpful for the person in terms of informing those behaviors, how we might best communicate that. And all of that's about human interaction and understanding humans. And so I guess that's where my interest in art and healthcare comes from.
Yeah, awesome, mate. Has that been something that has been in your practice since day one? Or is that something that's kind of evolved over time?
Oh, it certainly evolved over time. I was back in my physio training, it was all very biomedical and very technique focused. And my initial development as a clinician, I guess, was doing lots of courses and doing separate types of techniques and picking up new skills and applying those. And it was very much, I mean, it was a time when yellow flags was just emerging as a concept. But it was emerging as a concept in terms of, well, the person gets better if they do what we tell them to, unless they've got these other problems which are all theirs, and they're the reason why they don't get better. And the idea at that point in time of exploring what sort of sense this all makes to the person wasn't really something that I think I had been equipped to do. But over time, it seemed to me that the sorts of things that I was doing weren't making as much of a difference as one might hope, and that I was morphing towards spending more time talking around, you know, what were the sorts of things that were informing why people did things the way they did, which got me interested in, you know, beliefs and where these come from. And that got me interested in then the way that healthcare professionals influence people's beliefs and understanding. And so that's sort of the way where I morphed to sort of where I am now.
Yeah, I think I've had a similar evolution in my thinking in terms of in my practice as well, is that, like, as you say, some people would get better really, really well with that biomedical approach, whereas others wouldn't. And that kind of led me to start to question beliefs and making sense as well. And like I'm really interested in, like, as clinicians, we often think of beliefs as either positive or negative. So there's a lot of talk around nocebo. I've had lots of conversations around nocebo recently, and obviously that's a negative belief. We're trying to instill positive beliefs, but that might be a little bit reductionist, I think, in terms of at least my thinking around it. I mean, how do you think about people's beliefs in the context of a healthcare interaction? Like, is there a spectrum of beliefs? Is there just a positive belief or a negative belief?
Yeah, look, I mean, certainly there's a spectrum, and a belief might be positive for some aspects of someone's health, but maybe pose potential barriers to others. So, yeah, I think that dichotomous way of looking at things is not necessarily helpful. And possibly I'm guilty of promulgating that to a degree with developing questionnaires and things that tend to categorize some of these things. Because from a research perspective, sort of being able to identify if something's predominantly helpful or predominantly not, then can help you to measure something at a population level. But at the interaction with the person in front of me, then that's, I mean, I think you get a lot more information out of the discussion with the individual than you could ever get from any tool that might use as a screening tool or anything else. And that's where the opportunity comes to explore more, well, that belief, you know, how does that inform what you do, or how does it change how you feel? And then can think about that more at a personal level. But there are beliefs that are quite common in our society that seem to be regularly associated with people recovering less well, or there being barriers put in the way of their recovery. And so I guess you see patterns in beliefs that make you think, well, that could be a target that is something that we could discuss, that we might be able to reframe. And that might give you some different options for how you make your next choice about what to do.
And if we're thinking about some of those beliefs that are kind of predominantly barriers to people getting better, are there certain themes in regards to those beliefs that we should be looking out for as clinicians?
I always think, one, a belief about something that's happened in the past and the consequence of that being something which is going to determine my future can often be unhelpful in terms of, that means the future is almost written if you think about the person's narrative of their health. And so identifying those so that different explanations for what they've experienced in the past might be able to be raised, or other options of looking at things which might then enable that narrative for the future to have a potentially a happier ending. I think they're key ones. I mean, there are, you know, very structure-focused beliefs and diagnostic beliefs which are invariably given to someone through a healthcare system, which can become real focuses for representing what the person feels. And so they, you know, sometimes there might not necessarily be as good a concordance between what I think of as the pattern associated with a particular structure or a particular diagnosis and what their experience is. And so, you know, that might be a place to explore opportunities to view things differently. And then there's a whole lot of beliefs around what is good or bad. You know, you talked about us dichotomizing things, but I think the general public, or probably through healthcare, dichotomize many behaviors as being good ones or bad ones. And often the evidence to support that is either poor or non-existent, or says something quite to the contrary. And so I think those are also key beliefs to look out for.
Yeah, and you mentioned before that you're not on Facebook, which is probably a good thing, because that also propagates some negative beliefs, I'm sure. Maybe Instagram is even worse, actually, for some of the stuff that fitness influencers say there. So we're kind of looking at the way that people have the beliefs that they have around previous experiences for health challenges, maybe some negative messaging around a diagnosis from another healthcare professional, and also kind of the way that society views a problem as good or bad, or potentially also like someone within their close circle, or that provides some social proof of a negative outcome for this health challenge as well.
Yeah, and also just certain behaviours are viewed as being good or bad behaviours. You know, slouching is a bad thing to do. Lifting is a bad thing to do. You know, there's all sorts of things, and there are rule sets that are defined around that. I mean, you talk about health influences, but, you know, trainers in gyms or physios teaching techniques for using gym equipment also often seem to have very rule-focused. Don't let your knees over the middle of your feet when you do a squat. Don't, you know, allow your back to flex when you do a deadlift. Don't do this, don't do that. When the body is such an amazing, adaptable, multi-faceted or multi-opportunity type system that, you know, rules and only having a single way for doing a particular activity and not being able to adapt that based upon what your own physique is, what your own health challenges are, and all those other things can often really limit people's options and not give them the opportunity to move out of whichever, you know, rut that they might be in at that point in time.
Yeah, and I think it can probably also increase a reliance on that patient-clinician interaction as well. I'm just kind of thinking, like, if you're ACL rehabbing someone in the gym and you're getting them to do certain exercises, at some point you need to bring in a little bit of uncertainty and you need to broaden the horizon so that this person can get back to football or to basketball or to their manual job as well and open that up. And if you have set that belief as these are the rules that you need to follow, otherwise things are going to go pear-shaped for you, then you put up a barrier to your ability to progress with that person.
Yeah, and more importantly, that you need me to tell you what the rules are rather than I'm going to equip you to go out and gather new sensory data, new experiences that you can then integrate and then develop and broaden your understanding of what you're capable of and build your own efficacy for your ability to determine what's safe, to make progressions, to test things that might feel a little bit unsafe, and then, you know, continually update your understanding.
I'm interested in your take on rules right at the beginning. So if we've got someone coming in with an acute injury or an acute health challenge, in the early stages, I do find sometimes it is helpful just to pull people back a little bit and to hold them in a little bit closer to start with before allowing things to expand and allowing them to go and explore and empowering them a wee bit more. What's your take on that? Is there a place for rules, I guess, is the question that I'm asking?
Guidance. I mean, rules are made to be broken, but I think that it's also very individual. There are people who have an acute health experience and immediately become incredibly withdrawn, avoidant, fearful. And there'll be others who continue to push on and continue to flare and, you know, overstimulate the system at a time when actually it requires just a little bit more space to calm things down. And so, again, I'm not sure that there's a rule around that, because it's dependent on you and me as to, you know, how we need to, what's going to work best for you in this situation. But I guess in terms of rules, do I think it's a good idea for someone to continue to do something that flares up their nervous system and causes large amounts of pain? Well, no, I don't think that's a good idea, because I know that there are a whole lot of processes that will happen in the nervous system that might take quite some time to reverse if we set it up in the wrong way at the start. But again, that there's no rules around what that might or might not be, because it's going to change for the individual. And, you know, even when we think about acute, well, you know, sometimes we get some very good evidence that there has been some acute tissue disruption. We get bruising, we get swelling, we get, you know, defects that we can feel, those sorts of things. But often the onset of the experience happened at a point in time. But whether or not there's been tissue damage associated with that is very hard for us to tell and very hard for the person to tell. And maybe what we need to do is equip them with a framework through which they can test that out. Because often their understanding is that if it hurts, I must have damaged something. Whereas my understanding is that if it hurts, the system's detected a threat that it's looking to protect you from. And they're quite different spaces to start the conversation. And I think, you know, that initial assessment is to try and establish some idea of, well, how bad do we think this is, and therefore what do we think the best way to get the more information if there's some uncertainty with that, or what's going to establish the best environment to initiate that recovery.
Yeah, is there some nasty shit that we need to act on now, or can we reassure and slowly progress someone? And you mentioned having a framework to work through. I mean, do you have a handy framework that you use?
Oh, look, I mean, a handy framework. I have a framework that pain is always influenced by a lot of stuff. Some of it will be in your body, some of it will be in your head, some of it will be in your world, some of it will be in your past, some of it will be in your future. There's all sorts of things. And there are ways we can try and find out what some of those influences are, but most of them we'll never discover. So, you know, I think that always been open to this being able to be influenced by a whole range of things, and that if I just focus on your ankle, I'm going to miss a lot of it. And then two, that pain is invariably safe to feel. And it's that, so that it's safe to feel some pain, but that, you know, as we talked about, it's not sensible to push so far into that, that then you need to lie down for 2 days afterwards. And so that going back to the NOI group type, you know, mountains graph, that idea that, look, it's safe to feel some pain, but you don't want to get into that flare-up zone. And then we need to work out where that medium is between the two, and then we can push on from there. And I believe that that is safe to do in an acute sense as well as in a chronic sense, because the model still works. Pain is still pain at that point in time.
Definitely. And I mean, I've been injured often enough to know that it is very safe to push into some pain, but obviously not go so far that you stir things up. I was playing indoor netball one day and I landed heavily and felt something happen in my calf. I was going to say I felt my calf go, but I don't know
if it was. It felt like it went.
It felt like it went. One of my colleagues said, do you want me to order you an ultrasound? I was like, nah, I don't want to know. Because if there is a tear in there, that's gonna slow me down. Because I had a marathon that I needed to run in 10 weeks' time. And I decided, okay, I'm going to be back out running in 2 weeks. And like, thankfully, I've got a little bit of inside knowledge in terms of the stuff that I needed to do. But I managed to get out and go for a run. I think it was about 8Ks 2 weeks after doing it. And it was still sore, but that was okay. It wasn't any worse afterwards. And I could push into it and I could go slowly and get back into that, even in that acute stage in parentheses.
Yeah, well, so much of life is better if you're curious, hey?
Mm.
And it's approaching it with, yeah, you know, well, maybe that this might be okay. Here's a relative, you know, again, there's a framework around there. You didn't go out and do a 10K run. You set a framework of what feels like it might be safe, possibly slightly conservative for the first time. Let's go out. We'll gather the data from that. I'm open to it, you know, being okay. But also I'm open to getting the feedback that now's too early and that I need to, and so that we can just use that to constantly inform where we go. But I think that so often, particularly when experiences become more persistent and people's lives become more limited, then that curiosity gets overwhelmed by the rules. And so it's the rules rather than the going and seeking new data that becomes the predominant approach. And so I think often that's our role with those people, is starting to excite some of that. Well, let's go and test some of that out, because I reckon that there might be different options.
And I think what you just said there as well, Ben, probably butts up against a few of our clinical beliefs as well. I mean, a lot of us went through training, as you said, kind of in that biomedical way or biomechanical way, and that's still ingrained in our mind, and we still hold those beliefs and those biases. And I know that you've done some research as well around the beliefs that clinicians hold and how that affects patient outcomes. And I mean, you don't need to have a chat about it at the moment, but kind of the general sense was that the more clinicians viewed their patient's health challenges as negative or unlikely to improve, the worse the patient's outcomes were. Is that?
There has been research along those lines. Mine's particularly around the more biomedically oriented a clinician is, the more likely or the more fear avoidant they are. So the more fearful they are of doing things that hurt or that might increase injury, then the more restrictive they tend to be in the advice that they give to their patients. More likely they are to, say, to engage in bed rest or to take more time off work or be more cautious about activity. And then there's the association between their beliefs and those of their patients. And so, you know, that belief not only affects what they say to the person, but also how the person tends to view the problem as well. And as you say, you know, it all comes from a position, the clinician wanting to be helpful, but the structure that informed their beliefs and their own experiences come into this as well. It caused them to be on that cautious side, which then limits some of the options that they provide to their patients.
Hey there, team. We're just taking a short break in the chat to let you know about something really exciting. Podcasts are great, and I'm sure that you're getting a whole heap from this one, but they don't always move the needle on improving our skill set and the human side of healthcare. And that's why I've set up the Art of Healthcare team. It's a safe and supportive online community of healthcare providers learning from experts and each other about how to really up our game in the human skill sets that are vital for delivering healthcare in the future. So when you're ready, we'd love for you to join us. Head on over to team.artofhealthcare.nz to find out more and to sign up. Back to the show. Do you have any suggestions for how we kind of start to challenge our own biases if we think that we are a little bit cautious or do have some biomedical hangovers?
Yeah, well, mine was to put them back inside a black box and not worry about any of the bits anymore. Because, you know, I guess I went through a time when I thought I was very good at diagnosing particular patho-anatomical dysfunctions within a back. And although there was some research that said we weren't any good at that, I was obviously better than the average, and so therefore I could do that. And when I gave people models based upon that, most of them seemed to do okay, and that was possibly natural history, but there would have been some good stuff that they were getting out of the interaction packaged into that. But over time, as I started to actually believe that I wasn't better than the evidence said, and that the structure probably wasn't as important as I was giving it credit for, it means that with those consultations, I stop trying to identify the bit that hurts and start focusing more on the strategies or the things that look like they might, you know, be in the way of someone recovering or might give them different opportunities or different ways of approaching things, and not talk about the nuts and bolts, if you like. And initially, that's really scary because, you know, particularly when someone's coming to see me as the physiotherapy specialist, well, they expect specialist means I can look more specially at the different bits and pieces. And so you feel inadequate for not going there. But the more comfortable, the more often, and the more I changed my own rules based upon that. So I used to tell people when they had when I presumed they had discogenic back pain. Now, I wouldn't tell anyone that anymore, but at that point in time, that's the frame I was working with. That it was quite safe to do an extension and they could push into pain, but they should, particularly in that acute phase, be very cautious with flexion. They shouldn't sit down so much. And there's a whole lot of rules that went along with that. So I never tested someone and got them to do repeated flexion pushing into pain because for me that felt unsafe. But when I put the disc inside the black box with the rest of it and I got people to repeatedly flex and to be confident pushing into a bit of pain and doing exactly what I used to do with extension, I found that flexion was even better than extension was for helping someone to restore function when they had a sore back. And so I think it's that trying to do something differently. And then again, being curious, well, I wonder how this is going to go. I wonder whether or not all the patients are going to leave and say, well, that too, he doesn't know what he's talking about because he didn't even tell me whether it was my disc or my facet joint, or whether focusing more on the solutions rather than the problems might actually be something that people appreciate. And so far, my experience is generally good.
There's a lot of uncertainty as you start to step into that and start to kind of challenge your beliefs and push into areas that kind of almost seem to run counter to what you're holding tight at the moment. Like, do you still have moments where you're like, actually, I'm having a reaction to trying to do this because of beliefs that I deeply hold?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll still look at a scan sometimes. I mean, generally, I spend my whole life looking at people's scans saying, oh, don't worry about this. You know, these things I see on people's scans all the time. And then you'll see a scan every now and again, and your jaw will drop. You go, oh, my God. It's like, well, no, hang on. That's not fair. Just because there's a change there that looks more significant to me, there's no reason why I should disable this person because of that. So we can still go back to those same principles. And so, you know, there is those times when particularly if something visually affects you, that can cause you to go there.
And do you have a strategy that you utilize to kind of get you back on track and embrace that uncertainty a little bit more?
Yeah, it's turning away from the screen and back to the human.
Yeah, nice.
And look, I mean, I put a lot of store in logic as well. and being able to sort of work your way through things sequentially. And well, if that were true, then this would have to, should have happened, but that happened. So maybe there's other things we can think about with this. And, you know, well, yes, there's a significant change on that, Sam, but still remember that this person told me that, yes, they've had back pain for 20 years, but there have been periods of 2 or 3 years when they haven't had any problems. And this latest problem has really only been there for a year. Well, I know that change has been there for longer. So it can't be the whole story. But I would never say to the person that's not part of your story, because I think that's our other danger. If we can't remove the structure, we know that the body is constantly communicating with the brain. There's stuff going on in the body that is influential on how someone experiences their health. It's just not assuming that because we see something, it has to be, and that our ability to interpret what's going on in the body is always accurate.
I guess like kind of what you're saying there is it's about embracing the scientific method as you're dealing with that uncertainty. It's kind of working through it logically. It's testing your assumptions, even though you feel a little bit challenged by them.
It's all about hypotheses and testing those through a human.
Mm.
So everyone's their own single case experiment, because they are, you know, every person is unique in terms of everything that's gone into influencing them coming into that room on that day. And so, yeah, I think the best I can do is try and come up with some theories that might explain some of that experience, and then some experiments that we could work on to try and gather data that might suggest whether those theories hold any particular weight or relevance to that person, and then we can strengthen them or we can change the theory if it doesn't seem to be giving the results that we were looking for.
Awesome. And I think, Ben, like you mentioned this, like your area of interest, and like what we've been talking about a lot is back pain here, and there are a multitude of factors that affect that, from obviously the biomechanical stuff that's happening in the back to how well you're sleeping, whether you've had a fight with your partner, if you're worried about losing your job, kind of through to how well hydrated you are, and so on and so forth. And I think as you said, it's often about kind of looking for those barriers for people, those barriers that are going to stop people moving forward, and seeing, hey, is there some way that we can change this, or we can move this slightly, or work you around this barrier to continue to progress? And I think for a lot of people, like we've talked about the beliefs that they hold, by and large, the majority of society, I would say, still holds quite a biomedical view of their health. So that's sometimes a reasonably challenging conversation to have with them, to start to go and explore some of this other stuff, because people are like, why are you asking me about that when you should be asking me about my back? And one of the ways that I think that we can help facilitate that conversation, and one of the ways that I know that you are excited about at the moment, is like, how do we initially establish a connection for that person? How do we create a safe container for our clinician person interaction, so that people feel comfortable sharing this information with us? That was a really long-winded, contextual heavy question for you. Basically, how do you set up the container for your interaction with a person in a way that they're going to want to share this wide range of stuff with you, not just where their back's sore and how much it hurts out of 10?
Yeah, I mean, one, I think, is setting out a framework for what's going to happen in our consultation. And I'm really privileged in that I get an hour with a new person whom I see. And so I can set up the expectation within that of, so what, you know, it means I've got more time, and I like to use that time to explore your story, your experience, And so that then I can just see within that, you know, are there maybe opportunities that haven't been explored? Maybe are there other things, you know, things that might be able to be looked at in a different way, and then see if we can come up with a plan. And so that, you know, already the process has been laid out in terms of going to gather information from you. I'm going to then have some input and some, you know, gather some more information through the examination, and then have a work with you to see what are there solutions with that. And so that sort of starts to set that frame. But then, I mean, I was really lucky. Once I used to work in a teaching clinic where final year physiotherapy students came through. And once we had a Māori, a physio student came through, and she wrote on the top of the whiteboard in each of the consultation rooms, whakawhanaunatanga, which for the international audience, it's a Māori word that is about making connections between people. And up until then, I don't think that was a concept that I'd really come across. And so started to explore that more, because I had also observed that this student was phenomenal at making relationships with her patients. And that she, you know, I wouldn't have thought she was outstanding in any way clinically compared to other physiotherapy students. However, she was the one that they were all sad to see go and what talking about for multiple weeks afterwards. And so, you know, that framework of how you might establish a connection with someone, which is about sharing things about yourself, your family, your where you come from, your own interests, and offering the person or inviting the person to share details about themselves as a way of us connecting as humans before we find out about this problem, I find is really useful. And initially, as something I thought, oh, well, this is a Te Ao Māori concept. I'll use it as a way of establishing relationships with my Māori patients. But why am I denying this opportunity to all my other patients? Because actually, that investment of, you know, it's usually only 5 minutes, it might be 10 with some people, gives us so much in terms of the rest of the consultation and our relationship, and then the person's comfort to engage with me as a human, which means that they can share more than if I'm a white coat sitting inside an office. And so I think that's the other thing that I try and do. But I've also been influenced by Maxi Michak's work around that creating the safe therapeutic container, and the being present, the being engaged, all of those sorts of things that you can make sure you're doing to build that therapeutic alliance.
Mm. Awesome. How deep do you go in terms of the stuff that you share about yourself?
Oh, look, I mean, again, you rules. No, but I mean, I have some things that I've decided I'm quite comfortable to share. And so, you know, those will be the things that I will offer as standard. I mean, you don't want to have a patter as such, but you almost do in terms of how that goes. But then depending on what the person shares, then there'll be different. The process of whakawhanaunatanga isn't just me speaking and you speaking. It's us using those interests, experiences, backgrounds as places to find connection points. And so, you know, it will be very dependent on the individual as to how that might play out. But I think over time I have become more relaxed about being open with my patients. Initially it's, oh, this is a therapeutic relationship. Anything from me stays out of this because that's not professional and I don't want people stalking me. But nobody wants to stalk me anyway. They've got better things to do. And actually, it's not, if it's just clinical, that's just biomedical, and we're missing all sorts of opportunity. And so that's where actually I've got to bring myself as a human, because that's what enables that connection.
Yeah. And I think it's, we often forget that we're human too as well. And we're an important part. Us being human is an important part of that human connection. That if we're too busy trying to be professional and too busy trying to be clinical, that we reduce the ability to have that human to human connection. We reduce the trust in the relationship. We reduce that safety, and we probably increase the power imbalance between the clinician and the person that we're looking after.
Well, and we also ignore our own biases, because I'm the professional. So I'm the one who, you know, is I'm trying to think of the right words that go with that, you know, is authoritative, but also is impartial. But I can't be impartial. I've got a whole cultural, you know, as a physio, we've got a cultural grouping that has particular behaviors, particular ways of looking at the world, all these different things. And unless I identify myself as a human who's a physiotherapist, who's a father, who is an academic, who is a touch rugby player, who's a skier, who's Pākehā, who's, you know, all these different things, if I don't acknowledge that, then I won't realize the influence that's having on how I engage with a person. And therefore, that's going to have all sorts of other potential negative impacts. And so, yeah, I totally agree with you. We're fooling ourselves if we think that we are able to be an impartial clinicians and doing a disservice probably to ourselves as well as to our patients.
100% agree with that, mate.
Excellent.
I don't know if there's any research on this or not, but I'm really fascinated in terms of the, like, the connection between that and holding ourselves and just being a professional clinician and the relationship with burnout in health professionals as well. And that's just kind of a statement just to float out in there into the ether. Like, if you know of any research, that I'd be fascinated, but that's kind of a hypothesis.
There's aspects of it that I've seen come through research, but I don't think I have seen it researched as a topic on its own. So it's certainly, Totoko, your interest in the field, and I'll be happy to supervise your master's, Chris. Or PhD, if you already have one. I have no idea.
Claire Killingback suggested that I do some more postgrad as well when I was talking to her. Bloody academics, eh?
You're always on the recruit.
Mindful of the time, health professionals are busy. What practically should we do tomorrow after listening to this conversation? When we go in and have an interaction with someone, what's one thing that we can do?
Share something of yourself.
Nice. That's a great, straightforward, simple one. And actually, I've got one more question for you too, mate. Is there a belief that you've changed your mind about in the last 6 months that has positively impacted your life?
That's very spot-putting, isn't it? I'm sure that it's one of those things where there are all sorts of beliefs. I'm just trying to think that running with a mask is not possible. Would be, if I'm just thinking about, well, what are the beliefs? Yeah, that's the sort of thing that I would need to sit down and do more specific reflection about to be able to come up with a coherent.
That's right. I'm good with the running with the mask one at the moment. I should have sent that through to you before we started talking, but it just kind of popped in my head. I was like, well, I wonder what's going on there.
Yeah, and it is something that should be closer to the front of my mind, because I do remember having a reflection on something, thinking, wow, that's completely different to what I would have said a couple of months ago. But I didn't write the reflective statement that I was anticipating writing after that aha moment or that kapow. And if I had, I probably would have reinforced within my mind what that particular change was. But I think that you're right in that we should always be looking out for those, because it is great to realize that you are changing and developing. And I often see that as the mark of people who I really respect, as someone whom I can see is now doing or promulgating stuff that is completely different to what they were doing before, and even better, the ones that are honest and open about, look, I used to think this, but now I think that, and I'm really sorry I did that, but it was the best thing we could come up with at the time. And that process of continually changing and developing is what I think keeps one, you know, the world really interesting, but two, shows that you're open and curious and not just getting yourself set within your rule-based ways.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that too, mate. Ben, if people are interested in reading your multitude of articles or publications, or connecting with you, is there a place where they can do
it? I mean, I am on Twitter. It's somewhat of a inconsistent user, but certainly I am there, and every now and again you'll see me pop up. In terms of finding articles and things, I mean, Google Scholar's as good as anything else. Also, I've got a page on the Otago website, so just otago.ac.nz/Bendalo, or, you know, one word type thing, and that then you can find whatever the university has collated as my recent publications, and so they're probably the two best. And then my email address and contact details are all there if people want to reach out.
Awesome, mate. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure having a conversation with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
That's a wrap, team. I really hope you enjoyed that one. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is to share this episode out with your friends, your colleagues, your mum, someone who you think might enjoy it, and to make sure that you hit subscribe on your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. For more resources for all the episodes, for more information about the Art of Healthcare team, head on over to artofhealthcare.nz and you can find all of that stuff there. The amazing theme music for the episode was produced by my brother Jeremy Desmond, but otherwise you can blame me and my wonderful guest for the rest of the stuff. Thank you guys again so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for showing the love. I really appreciate you. Have a great week.